Geocaching is an easy way for you and your family to burn calories and have fun at the same time. Plus, the number of overweight and obese children in Canada is growing, and we answer your questions and emails. All this and more on episode number 32 of Fat to Fit Radio.
Welcome to Fat to Fit Radio, your source for real weight loss solutions without the hype. And now, here are your hosts, Jeff Ainsley and Russ Turley.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to show number 32. How is it going this week, Jeff?
Excellent, and I'm looking forward to a great show. So, Russ, let's get right into your weigh-in.
Yeah, it's been 2 weeks now, and I am down to 264.4. So, let's say 2 weeks ago, that's 3.5 pounds, give or take, if I'm not mistaken.
And that means you've lost a total of 31.6 pounds in 32 shows, which is excellent. We're starting to see some really respectable totals here. What do you think?
I am catching up. You know, it's if it was a pound a show, I'm getting pretty close to that. Now I'm hoping I can just rocket past this point and have more than 1 pound for each show here going forward. So looking forward to that.
Well, it is now the start of summer. We both just had our long weekends. I had the Victoria Day long weekend, which is kind of the unofficial start of summer here in Canada. That's when everyone plants their gardens. It's really the start of summer. And went camping for the weekend. It was a really good time. We had awesome weather. And I understand last weekend, Russ, you guys had a Memorial Day weekend, right?
Yeah, we had Memorial Day weekend, 4 day. 4 days off myself. I had Friday off as well. So made it a 4 day, but didn't really have too much fun. I mentioned a couple weeks ago that my wife had abdominoplasty, or, you know, the nicer term is the tummy tuck. And she had that last Wednesday and has been, she's recovering pretty well right now. She got all the tubes taken out, which was extremely painful. And now she's really just, you know, lounging around, just really can't do much, can't lift anything up. And I was home for a week and I just got back to work. So that's been pretty much took up my whole week here, almost 2 weeks, because we're getting ready for that whole thing, getting the kids all squared away where they're going to go. And it's really, you know, takes up time.
Well, that's good to hear that everything went okay, because that was some pretty major surgery you were talking about.
Yeah, let me share here a little bit. I'm gonna try to get pictures now. I know she probably would kill me if I ever posted these, or if she knew I posted them. So, I'm gonna try to stealth them. I'm probably gonna post pictures. I'll maybe post links to them, but they are they will be amazing. You can already see. And the doctor removed between 10 and 12. He wasn't quite sure, but it was a good 10 inches of skin. Extra skin that was on her stomach from being stretched out from being pregnant 3 times. But that's all gone now. So, I'll try to post those pictures here in the future.
Well, we got quite a lot of email and comments in the last couple of weeks. So let's get right into them. And we're going to start with an email that came in from Dawn. And she wrote, "I love the show. Keep up the great work. I have a question for you. Those of us who have lost a great deal of weight are finding they need to fight a new battle. The battle of loose skin. I have lost about 95 pounds, and I'm finding I still have to hide under my clothes because I have hanging skin on my upper arms and thighs. I don't want to have plastic surgery. I think the scars would be just as unattractive. Is there anything that can be done to make this better?" And I think, Russ, you've got a lot of experience the last couple of weeks, so why don't you start?
Well, yeah, you know, I mentioned, I asked you that question, specifically for my mother, because she's lost about 75 pounds right now. And she is 60, I think it was 63 she just turned. And she has quite a lot of skin now. You know, she's not young by any means. And she has definitely, the skin is not as elastic. As you get older, you lose collagen. Dawn didn't mention how old she was. But, you know, as you get older, you lose that, the skin that bounces back. So I would suggest if you're going to lose weight, if you're going to do it sooner rather than later, because that skin will not always come back.
And like you said, Russ, skin naturally loses elasticity as you get older. And, you know, I see overweight students in high school right now, and I know if they lost, you know, 100 pounds before age 20, they would probably not have any trouble with that skin going back to normal. But year after year, and the longer the skin stays stretched out, the harder it is to get back. But I think in reality, a lot of this losing weight is more about health and living an extra 5 or 10 years. I mean, that's kind of the most important thing as well. And you can hope with time that skin will get back a little bit. It may take, you know, a couple years, but it should shrink a little bit.
Yeah, well, there's definitely no magic solution to shrink that skin, but losing the weight is the most important thing, and the extra skin, well, you know, if it loosens up, great, but otherwise you still have that benefit of not having all that extra weight.
And I think I said this quite a while ago, if you have a little bit of extra hanging skin, you could kind of show that off as a badge of honor. I mean, this is where I used to be and this is where I'm right now. And yeah, it might not look the best, but it still looks a lot better than having pounds and pounds of fat underneath it. So congratulations on losing that 95 pounds. And at worst, having some extra skin is not horrible. It's not going to harm your health by having some extra skin like the extra fat will.
All right. Well, our next email came in from Teresa to podcast at Fat to Fit Radio. And Teresa wrote, I had a 3,000 calorie aha moment. I travel a lot for biz, and a lot of the hotels that I go to offer you a sweet treat, i.e. a cookie, as a way of saying thank you. I always thought to myself, no big deal. I work out every morning. When I am on biz, I always work out in the morning for a minimum of 30 minutes. But from your show, I realized that I need to do more than 30 minutes if I'm going to have that cookie. An extra cookie is anywhere from 200 to 300 plus calories. At one chain that I will not say the name of, but it rhymes with Mumbletree, their cookie is 347 calories.
And she continues, so while I was having perhaps 2 or 3 cookies a week, over a month, that is an extra 2,400 plus calories a month, even if I do work out. Thanks for putting that into perspective on that show, that an extra 100 calories a day translates into 1 pound a month. I knew that, but when you break it down into something like a complimentary cookie, although it doesn't cost anything, I am paying for it big time by spending more time at the gym. So thanks for the wake up. So no thanks for the free cookie. And in response to this email, that is exactly it. Every little bit counts. I think the majority of people who are 50, 60 pounds overweight, they didn't pig out and go crazy and gain all this weight in a couple months. This was just an extra 1 or 2 cookies a week that over time gradually put on the weight. And naturally, as you get older, your metabolism slows down a little bit. So those cookies count for more and more, and you gain more and more weight. So it is every little bit that counts in the eating and every little bit of exercise that you're doing, just like we talked on the last show about walking upstairs and doing just the little things that you wouldn't think count. It all goes together to make losing weight and keeping it off a lot easier.
All right, very good. We have a third email this week, and it's from Jen. And Jen wrote, hello, Jeff and Russ. You guys probably have a list of items to talk about, but I was wondering if you have it on your list to talk about knees. My knees have been bothering me a lot, and I know that most of it is probably my weight, and I'm working on that. But I was wondering if there's anything you can do to strengthen them up. I'm afraid that at some point I'm going to have knee replacement.
I looked into this and looked at a couple places on the internet and talked to a couple people, and the short answer about your knees, the best thing you can do is lose weight to reduce the stress in your knees. Now, every joint in your body, there's an ideal range of weight and force that each joint can handle. So 50 pounds of extra body weight is 50 pounds of extra force on your knee joint with every single step. So you have to think that every time you step, whether it's thousands of steps per day, it's that extra 50 pounds on that joint over and over again. And about needing a knee replacement itself, that has a lot to do with your genetics. So the common term when people say you can wear out your knees, you know, through over your lifetime, through a lot of use, it's actually quite controversial because many lifelong runners can continue to run late into life, and a lot of people who don't do anything, they just kind of sit on the couch, need knee replacements in later in life. But I really think that it just means that it's not just the amount of use of the joint, but the amount of use of the joint past its design limitations. And I might be kind of going in circles, but here's an analogy that might kind of sum this together. Imagine that you have a car and you're using it, going the regular speed limit, it lasts a long time. Now, if you start hauling a trailer behind it that's quite heavy and the car is not designed to pull it, even if you're going at the speed limit and you're not doing anything crazy, that's really going to wear out the engine of the car a lot faster. And your joints are really the same thing. They're designed to have kind of an average body weight. The more weight that you have on it, even if you're not doing a lot of excessive use of those joints, they wear out a lot faster. And about strengthening your knee joint itself, you can strengthen the muscles around the knee joint to make the joint more stable through weight training, but the actual joint itself, there's not that much you can do because it's held in with tendons. And tendons are really responsible for holding the joint tightly together, and they really can't be strengthened. But improving the muscles around the knee will help it to some extent. But I think really to sum up, the best thing you can do for your knees is to get that extra weight off. I know myself, if I go hiking and I'm wearing a 75-pound backpack, my knees are killing me after a couple kilometers. So it really does make a difference. And if you don't believe me, lose the weight and find out.
Yeah, well, thank Don and Teresa and Jen for your questions and comments. And if you're out there, you're wondering, hey, how can I leave a comment? How can I send you guys a question? There are four ways to do it. The first is to leave us a comment on the website at fattofitradio.com.
Or you can send us an email to podcast@fattofitradio.com.
Way number three is to leave a voicemail. Go to the website and click on the button that says call me and enter your information to send us a free voicemail.
Or you can join our support group at fattofitsupport.com and you can leave us a message there.
All right, and now let's get into some news with the Web Report.
All right, my first news item is really similar for Canadians and Americans. It's more about a Canadian study, but I know that this is going to be applicable everywhere around the world. And I found this news article, and it was entitled, Canadian Kids Get Poor Grades in Fitness. I'll just read a short paragraph from it. Canada's report card on physical activity for children and youth for 2008 finds that 90% of Canadian children and youth are still failing to meet the guidelines outlined in Canada's physical activity guides for children and youth. The guidelines recommend 60 to 90 minutes of moderate intensity physical activity per day on most days of the week. So that's 90% of Canadian youth not getting anywhere near the recommended amount of exercise in the day. And one thing I noticed when I was reading through the study is they're no longer using terms like sitting in front of the TV or playing video games or being on the computer. There's a new term coming up just called screen time. And they're talking about the hours that children spend on the computer and in front just as screen time, because that's more about what we're all doing. It's not just TV, it's everything that's inactive. And this is one thing that I found really shocking. We did a show on childhood obesity a couple months ago, but here's the new statistics for Canada. The report found that 26% of Canadian children and youth are overweight or obese, and that the prevalence of obesity increases with the child's age. In children aged 2 to 5, 21.5% are overweight or obese. That's just amazing to me that a 2-year-old can be considered obese already. Then it continues that 26% of kids aged 6 to 11 and almost 30% of youth aged 12 to 17 are overweight and obese. So that just shows this trend is just going on and on, and it just seems to be getting worse and worse. And I just can't get over shocking that they have statistics for obese 2-year-olds. That was just shocking. So what do you have this week, Russ?
Well, first, you know, it's not as shocking as when you walk around the mall or down on the or by the office when I'm taking my walk at lunch, I see women with children. You know, we're talking about probably one or two with bottles of juice, and this is what they're giving their kids: bottles of juice. And I'm thinking, you're gonna have a fat kid there. And it's almost all, you know, you see the little portly kids walking around with their mother is they're not holding them because they're too heavy to hold. And so I see that more and more. So I'm not shocked by that at all. But anyway. This week I'm going to be going here the last time to talk about this thing called the vagus nerve, because it keeps running across my desk, and I thought this one is real close to me. It was a group study here at UC Irvine, and they're talking about this thing called V-block therapy, and they're working on this vagus nerve and how that helps them control hunger. And so, again, that's really all I'm going to say about it. It's a very interesting phenomena here, and four times it's come across my desk, so I think there's a lot of work going on here, and so check that out. There'll be a link in the show notes.
Well, let's move on to this week's feature section, which is geocaching.
Right, a couple weeks ago, Jeff and I talked about some stealth calorie burners, and one item we left off the list that both of us included in our own list was geocaching, and you might ask yourself, what are you talking about, geocaching? Well, number one, it's a great way to get exercise. Two, it's very accessible. Almost anyone can do it. You can do it almost anywhere. Three, it includes some cool technology called GPS. And also accessible-wise, it's cheap. For $100, you can get started. Or if you have a phone with GPS in it, you can actually do it for almost no money. So, Jeff, give us a little background on what geocaching is.
Well, first of all, geocaching is spelled geocaching. And the website to look this up is simply called geocaching.com. And what this is, it's a worldwide phenomenon, and it's an adventure game for GPS users. Now, a GPS unit looks at the satellites that go around the Earth, and it tells you where you are anywhere on the planet, probably within about 5 or 6 feet. So it's very accurate. And you just need an inexpensive GPS handheld unit, and you can easily get one for under $100. And once you have this, you can play this geocaching game. So this is how the game really works. You go to the website geocaching.com, and you look up a geocache, which is really a hidden treasure chest anywhere in the world. And generally, you can find thousands and thousands just anywhere in the world. So you get the coordinates. You use your handheld GPS device, and it points you to where this hidden treasure chest is. So on your GPS device, once you plug in the coordinates, it'll have a little pointer arrow, and it will tell you exactly the direction of your geocache. And to make it really oversimplified, you just follow the arrow until you get to where the geocache is hidden. It's generally out in the woods somewhere. It might be under a pile of sticks or something like that. And when you find the treasure chest, it might be a container. You open it up, you'll find some little prizes inside, you'll find a logbook to sign your name, etc. And that's really all there is to it. It seems deceptively simple.
Right, it does seem simple, but there's the difficulty in the terrain. There's also how hard that person hid this cache, this little treasure chest. And like Jeff said, usually they're a container, usually a Tupperware container. That's kind of the traditional geocache, but you can get ones that are intricately made, homemade units with PVC pipe or an ammunition box of from World War II. I mean, there's some very intricate geocache containers that I've seen and traded my treasure for. And that's the thing here. Once you find that geocache, that treasure chest, this is before you start going to hunt for that. You need to bring a couple items with you. Number one, you probably want to bring a pencil because there's not always one available to sign that logbook. Number two, you want to bring something to trade. Inside of each of these geocaches is a treasure. And, it's very simple things. It's very, really not extraordinary and would not be considered treasure by most people. But, it's part of the game. And so you take these items and trade one. You put one in and you take one out. And that's kind of the fun of it. And then you can use that in some other cache later on.
Now, people are probably wondering, why would you want to do this? The fun is in finding it and going to different locations. You're going to find within every city around the world, there's hundreds and hundreds of these hidden geocaches. People who start playing the game start creating their own geocaches. They get a Tupperware container and they hide it somewhere in their neighborhood. And the more adventurous people hide them out in the country. It is kind of neat. When I look up a geocache and I say, I would like to go out into the mountains, maybe an hour away from my house, and I'll get a list of maybe 5 or 10 geocaches that I'll go out and find. And it's weird. Anywhere in the world, I can find this exact location within a few feet and some searching. I will find this geocache. I'll sign the logbook. I come back to my computer later in the day and I put on the website, hey, I found this and this is what I found. So the fun is actually in going out and finding it. It's a fun way to go out and get exercise. You don't think of this, oh, I'm going to go work out today. because you have a goal to go find something. You might end up going hiking for half an hour and searching for 10 minutes to find this. It's not that you're just standing on a treadmill and walking and walking.
Right. And if you have children at home, this is a great way to get them out of the house, out in front of the screen we talked about earlier. And the kids don't even realize that they're out getting exercise. They're having so much fun just following the arrow on the GPS and watching themselves get closer and closer and getting excited and getting to trade those things. And that's really when the kids get to pick that item. Sometimes it takes them forever to pick the exactly right one that they're going to get, whether there's a matchbox car in there or something, other kind of toy. They just really love the idea of getting that little knickknack when they get to the geocache.
And another thing, before you go out and find any of these geocaches, every geocache on the website, when you first look it up, it tells you how hard the terrain is and how hard it is to find the geocache. So when you're first starting out, or you don't want to end up walking a half an hour to try and find one, you just look for the easy ones. That gets you started. You'll probably be able to find one within a mile of your house. So just find an easy one, get your GPS unit, maybe even walk from your house and try and find your first one. Once you find one or two, generally most people are hooked.
Yeah, while Jeff may be going out in the woods to find them, here in Long Beach, we practice what we call urban geocaching. You get to go out and hunt these caches, but most of the time here, it's in a park or in just really on a street somewhere, and there's not always a lot of walking to it. That's not always true, but again, urban geocaching, a little bit different than maybe what Jeff has been used to in Calgary.
But I guess the point is there's just geocaches everywhere. When we go on vacation, for example, we look at the city we're traveling to and we get a couple geocaches that are kind of close to our hotel, and that gets us out of the hotel and walking for some excuse to go find something. And you discover things along the way. I know when I go out into the mountains with my dogs, we never would have discovered any of these great locations if it wasn't for geocaching. I mean, we stop off at these logging roads and we walk down and we know where all these paths are and these great hidden streams. And it's just really one of the benefits of doing this game.
Right. Now, let's talk a little about the cache types, things you might find. There are a few different types of caches. And the first one is a regular type. It's going to be what we're talking about, kind of a larger Tupperware container. And then there's going to be a micro cache. What these are very small little containers, maybe a film canister, something even smaller. I've seen things the size of your pinky that were a cache and were hidden in just amazingly small places that were so hard to find.
That's right. And the thing about the micro caches, those little film canisters, they are quite hard to find. And those are more the advanced ones. You know, it says you can get within 5 or 10 feet of where the cache is, but that's dependent upon terrain. And if it's in the middle of summer and there's lots of leaves and underbrush and you're in the middle of the forest somewhere, it can be quite hard. There have been quite a few that we've gone out and not been able to find, and it's because they were at eye level, maybe attached to a tree, and we were searching the brush and moving all the leaves around and stuff and didn't find them. So micro caches, they generally will have some hints along them as well. So when you're looking up the coordinates of the geocache, you can read the hints, and it will save you a little bit of heartache if you're trying a very difficult one.
All right, and the third type is a multi-cache. And if geocaching is like a treasure hunt, this is like following a pirate's map to the treasure. And the hider will put little clues, maybe 3, 4, 5 sometimes, depending on the hider, that will send you to the next set of coordinates. So you might have 4 or 5 sets of coordinates that you need to follow to get to that final cache. And those are very challenging. Sometimes they've written them on a post and you have to find the post, or they're submerged in something. I mean, I've had some really strange multi-caches that have been probably the most fun. A fourth type of cache is called a location cache. Somebody will put in a location, coordinates of a caching event normally, or of if it's a location cache, it's just a beautiful place, say a great picture spot, a beautiful vista, something that is not necessarily a treasure hunt. It's just your destination is a beautiful, interesting place.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. I've never done a location one. Have you ever done a travel bug, Russ?
Travel bug, I have not myself done any kind of travel bugs. what a travel bug is for the uninitiated in geocaching. It is a little item, say like a figurine or some other, and it has a special tag on it. And if you go to the geocaching.com website and you put the information in for the travel bug, you can tell somebody where this travel bug wants to go. Say, I might put one here in Long Beach and say, you know what? This travel bug wants to go to South America. Well, the next person that finds that travel bug, maybe they're traveling, you know, across the country or to the next state. And so they bring it with them and put it in a cache in their state. And then they log where that travel bug is. And the next person takes it to the next location, closer to its final destination. And it's just adds a little more fun to the whole geocaching.
That's right. We have a couple travel bugs out in the wild. And what that means, we have little mini teddy bears and we have a little tag that we've put on it. And we can track where that travel bug has gone from country to country. One of ours, we just said, we want to go to every country in the world. And it's about a year and a half old and it's gone about 6,000 miles right now. And it tells you every time someone picks it up and drops it off, you receive an email and it tells you where the travel bug has now gone to and how far it's traveled throughout the world. So it's kind of a neat little thing. And if you ever find one, you just pick it up. If you can't bring it to that final destination, you can still pick it up and move it farther away just so that it's moving around. It's pretty neat to do and it's pretty neat to have one of your own as well.
All right. So Jeff, you've been doing geocaching for a while. What was your first cache you found?
Actually, the first time I went out looking for one, it had been raining for about a week and a half straight, and we went out in the mud. It was right by a stream, and we think it was washed away, and our first experience was walking through, you know, ankle-deep mud, searching and searching and never finding it, and we almost gave up on it that day because we didn't find it. So it's kind of started out negative for me. So now, about 2.5 years into it, you realize that's part of the finding a geocache. Is you might get dirty, you might get muddy, you might slip, but that's kind of part of the adventure. How about you, Russ? What was the first one you found?
Well, the first one, we're going on a trip to Durango quite a few years ago. I'm going to guess I've been doing it for probably 4 years. And so I heard about it and I thought, you know what? I'm going to do it. I ordered my GPS from Amazon and I printed out a couple of caches in Durango and I put the thing in the bag and off we went. So the second day we're out, we're thinking, well, what do we want to do now? I thought, perfect time. Hey, let's go geocaching. Everybody look at me like I'm crazy. Look, I've got a little device. And so I took the whole family. My mother-in-law had her sandals on, and she pretty much stayed by the car when we got to it. But it was ended up being this great location. It was this kind of a state park there that had about 100 feet vertical that you had to go up, but it was only about a quarter mile of walking. So it was very challenging terrain, but we were successful in our first one and, actually fed our craze for getting these geocaches. What has been your hardest geocache you've found?
Well, the hardest one we actually never found because we ran out of time. We were actually traveling and we wanted to do a couple along the way. And like I said, geocaching seems so simple. You just follow the direction on your compass. We ended up being at a large dam and we're walking and it says it's about 3-4 feet ahead of us. And we're right at the top of this really steep bluff. And it turned out that we were at the top of the bluff. We'd have to walk, you know, maybe a half hour to go all the way around back down to the water's edge at the bottom and find it there. So that was the most frustrating because we were so close. There was no way we could climb down and get it. So that's part of the thrill too. It's not always as easy as you think you'd be. You can be 3 feet close to it and it's literally, you know, a couple hundred feet away down a cliff. How about you, Russ?
Well, I have to say the most fun and the most challenging geocache I've ever found was, it was under about 15 feet of water. It was one called the Swimmer's Cache and is over here in the called the Alamitos Bay. And my sister-in-law and I, I got her into it as well. And we decided to go out together to this swimmer's cache. And the prize was a button that said, I went to the swimmer's cache. This guy had a piece of four-inch PVC with holes in it. It was sunk down to the bottom and attached to the chain and into two places that held a buoy in place. So you had to swim out to it, which was, you know, maybe, 500 yards. I mean, it was a good swim. Wow. And then you had to go ahead and dive down to the bottom. And it's funny is because just, you know, we went the long way. You could have just as easily walked to the other side of the bay and jumped in from the boat dock. So it was actually, we made it more challenging than it actually was. And that's ended up where we got out. We just went over to the side, got up on the boat dock, and then walked around back to our car. But, you know, it was, you know, so many yards away and swimming, it seemed just so much more intense. And we ended up getting it and going down, you know, 15 feet, grabbing this geocache, dragging it up to the dock, and then putting it back, which actually was just as hard as getting it, because you had to get down and attach it in these two places to kind of make sure it didn't float away with the tide or get all caught up. So that was probably the hardest one.
Well, I think our listeners can really gather from us talking about this that we enjoy it quite a bit, and it really gets us out of the house, and it gives us an excuse to go walking around in the city or even out in the country, places that you wouldn't be going just by yourself most likely, and it is exercise, even if you're not thinking about it. And if this has inspired people to try this out, we'll leave some links in the show notes. And the main site where you go to is just www.geocaching.com. You'll find most of the information there. We'll also put some links to the GPS units that we both have. And you'll see they're nothing special. They're quite cheap. There's not built-in maps or anything. They just really have the basic functionality of being able to point towards location on the planet. And that's all you really need. So this is something, obviously, that both myself and Russ would suggest that you give it a shot. You know, it's pretty inexpensive. It's kind of like gym fees for 1 month, and you can be using that same GPS unit for years to come. Let's move on to the recipe of the week.
All right. It's going to be no yipping and whooping it up for this one, but it is a Mexican recipe again. This time, it is low-calorie, low-fat tostadas. I found this over at dietbites.com, and these things have 100 calories each. You can have two or three and still not blow your calorie count for the day. So check out the recipe. There'll be a link in the show notes for these low-fat, low-calorie tostadas. All right, so Jeff, what is our homework for this week?
Well, the homework that I have this week was inspired by the email that talked about their sore knees. And the homework is simply to come up with a list of all of the ailments that you think that your weight might be responsible for. So many of the things that you might come up with, you might think are just a result of age, but include them anyway, because they're probably still partially related. Once you have this list, perhaps it might help you out with keeping you motivated along your journey towards fitness. So for example, one of the big things when I was about 50 pounds heavier, I didn't sleep very well, and I used to have aches in my legs when I went to bed at night. So those are two things for me. Everyone will be different. So come up with those things that you know are probably related to your weight and keep them in the back of your mind when you're thinking of having an apple or a donut. It does help a little bit more ammunition.
All right, excellent. So what is our motivational quote this week?
Okay, and here's the quote. If you spend too much time learning the tricks of the trade, you may not learn the trade. There are no shortcuts. If you're working on finding a shortcut, the easy way, you're not working hard enough on the fundamentals. You may get away with it for a spell, but there's no substitute for the basics. And the first basic is good, old-fashioned hard work. And that's from John Wooden.
All right. Thank you very much, Jeff. And thank you, everyone out there, for downloading the show and for listening. And again, you'll find all the show notes and for all the links over at fattofitradio.com. And we will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Send your feedback or questions to podcast@fattofitradio.com. For more information on today's show or any previous shows, visit the website at fattofitradio.com. If you would like to support the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast directory.